and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in today. It's good to have you all with us. As you might recall, we were actually on location at the last year's American Renaissance Conference. Not streaming the speeches, but we're kind of doing interviews with attendees. Some more behind-the-scenes kind of coverage. Unfortunately, this year we couldn't make it. It came at a time when we had a lot of other things actually going on. And even Reinhardt, who we wanted to send to do coverage of Amarin, actually was on an extended visit in Europe after doing a filming event for us in Norway, in Oslo. So we have actually invited back to the show Jared Taylor from American Renaissance to kind of give us an update, if you will, on the recent conference, the success of it and stuff like that. So welcome back, Jared. Always a pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's always an honor to be interviewed by you, Hendrik. It was a great disappointment that Red Ice was not at the American Renaissance Conference this time. Your presence last year added to kind of the sense of drama and excitement. It was a great conference last year. In some respects, it was an even better conference this year. One of the points I want to point out is that for the first time, we actually had to turn people away. We bumped up against the legal fire code limit on the meeting room, and we had a maximum of 300 people. So we had to close registration a full month before the conference itself. And ordinarily, we get 100, 150 registrations during that last month. So my guess is, instead of 300 people, we could have had 450 people there. As it is, we had a waiting list of 50, 75 people who said, if somebody cancels, please give us an opportunity. So it was heartbreaking to have to turn people away.
Yeah, were there people showing up at the door that tried to buy tickets that couldn't get in?
We told them that they could not do that.
Right,
but
right.
Some people did anyway. Yes, no, there's huge pent-up demand for meetings of this kind where like-minded people can exchange experiences, ideas. It was really, the conference was just electric with excitement, optimism, people looking forward to what's going to happen next. It was really a wonderful conference. As the sponsor of the conference, it seems unseemly for me to say such things, but I think I can speak for practically everyone who was there.
I know I ask this every time, but what's changed? I mean, American Renaissance have been doing conferences for how many years is it? 15, 10 years?
Our first one was in 1994, believe it or not.
Oh, there you go.
So,
yeah.
Yes, we've been doing it for a long time, a very long time. What has happened, I think that for whatever reasons, and I think there are many that we can point to and we can discuss these reasons if you like, but more and more white people are waking up to the terrible crisis we as a race face. And since there are so many more people who are understanding this crisis, there are just that many more people who want to get together and talk about it. This is really, for me, in all of the 27 years, it's hard to imagine it's been that long, that I've been a white activist, these last several years have been just a wonderful awakening. You could call it the Great Awakening of white racial consciousness, not just in the United States, but I believe all around the world.
Also, Jared, a lot of protests this year, more so. I think when we were there previous year, it looked like it was kind of dwindling out a little bit, I guess. It was not many there at all, but this year that was different. So I guess they're ramping up too.
Well, it's come in waves. When we first started meeting at Montgomery Bell Park in Tennessee, this was our sixth year, actually. The first year, there was quite a turnout, and they had what they called an alternative conference. I don't know how many people actually attended. Since that time, every year, the number of demonstrators has dwindled, except for just last year, there was an uptick, and this year, there was a real uptick. And I think what we're seeing is this typical lefty response to the major defeat, which is the election of Donald Trump. As you're well aware, the Antifa and the Black Bloc have been far more active since the election of Donald Trump, rioting in Berkeley, shouting down people such as Charles Murray, Heather McDonald. And on this occasion as well, for the first time, we had Black Bloc people with face masks, waving the black flag, and really trying to be as provocative as possible, trying to press in as close to the conference. They were much more intrusive than they've been in the past, but we are guarded by the park police, who do a marvelous job of keeping them out of our hair. So it was as if when you register for the American Renaissance Conference, you also get a ticket to the zoo.
Yeah, exactly. And there was one run-in that I read about on Amarin.com.
Yes, unfortunately, there was a confrontation between one of their between one of our people and several of theirs, and our fellow ended up in the hospital. He was also arrested for disorderly conduct. We have tried to raise some money for his hospitalization bills and for his legal defense. We'll see what comes of that, but it was a very unfortunate thing. I had urged all of our people absolutely to ignore any kind of provocation whatsoever. Unfortunately, he actually found himself in a situation where he was face-to-face in contact with these people, and as you can see from the screen, the kind of folks they are, the outcome wasn't pleasant.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It is what it is, and these people, of course, they have no problem going for violence and stuff like that, and if you end up in a situation of self-defense, that's how it goes. It's very unfortunate. That. And speaking of which, we have, of course, there might be much more of this this coming Saturday, Jared, and I wanted to ask you your opinion. What do you think the Unite the Right event in Charlottesville is going to be like?
Well, it can turn out all sorts of different ways. As you know, the city has said that they are not supposed to meet in the downtown park where they had originally gotten the permit for the meeting. The ACLU, I understand, has come to their side and said, no, 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 you can't chase them away. So let us hope that the meeting comes off as planned. If it doesn't, I understand that organizers have decided they'll meet in what used to be Robert E. Lee Park and is now Emancipation Park anyway. And if that happens, then who knows what will happen. My guess is they could be cleared with tear gas, or they could be told, look, if you stick around, we will arrest you. Then we'll see if people are arrested. It could be a nasty situation. If it comes to that, my guess is that none of the speakers will be able to deliver their talks, or they may gather later on, choking with tear gas out in the other area where the city has told them that they can meet. But this is going to be quite a dramatic event, I'm sure.
Yeah, it seems like it. It's going to be very interesting to see how it unfolds and the way the authorities, the local authorities, how they're going to respond and what they'll be able to do in terms of how many people are going to show up. They're expecting thousands. But just as a bigger issue tying to what's happening in Charlottesville, you know, much of this is coming in a response to what the city council people have actually done in the city, which is, of course, is rename the parks. They're planning on removing the Robert E. Lee statue. I mean, finally, there's some real opposition organization against making sure that this doesn't happen. And I'm really glad to see that, you know, finally people are fighting back and making it not easy for these council people just to remove our heritage and history and get away with it without anyone saying anything at all, right?
Yes, yes. This is a very, very important thing. And it's a point I like to make to Northerners as well as Southerners. They're coming for Southern heritage now because anything that they can tie to slavery in any possible way will become the enemy. In this case, Robert E. Lee, he opposed slavery, he opposed secession, and he fought for the Confederacy only after Virginia seceded, and he was actually offered the command of the Northern armies to put down what the Yankees considered a rebellion. And he was considering that offer until Virginia seceded, and he says, no, I cannot draw my sword against my home state. So despite the fact that Robert E. Lee opposed slavery, opposed secession, but he did fight for his native state, despite the fact that he was widely considered by people on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line to be one of the most honorable, one of the finest officers that ever took the field, his memory must be erased because of this alleged taint of slavery. I'd like to point out that when that statue was first erected in 1924, there were still veterans of the Union Army. They were people who had actually fought against Robert E. Lee on the battlefield. Did they oppose honoring him? No. There was widespread respect for a man who was a patriot, who fought for his native state and for his country. It is only as the past drifts further and further into the past that we take this utterly self-righteous, crazy attitude towards the Confederacy. And what I like to point out to Yankees is that if Robert E. Lee is a bad guy, if Robert E. Lee, this noble man, this great general from American history, is a bad guy, what about George Washington? George Washington had slaves. Are we going to rename the capital city? The White House, is that a symbol of white supremacy? You cannot stop with any of this stuff. This is ultimately an attack on white people. And to take the name of the park, named after Robert E. Lee, really the most revered man in the entire South, and call it Emancipation Park, it just goes to show you that more and more these people pretend that the only events in American history of any importance are those having to do with blacks, with slavery, with minorities. And I tell Yankees, they're coming for you next.
Yeah, so I remember an article a few years ago. This is a republishing of the issue on New York Times here in 2016. Where they're talking about the fact that, yes, the White House was built by slaves, right? So I believe you're right, Jared. I mean, this is, it's not going to end at this stage where it's at now. You might have a lot of Northerners or Yankees, whatever, that agrees with this or they think it's horrible or whatever. But as you say, they're not going to settle for that. And eventually, you know, I guess as you propose in one of your videos, they will turn it into a rainbow house or something like that, right?
That's right. The house of many colors.
That's right, yeah.
They'll paint it with the same flag, with the colors of the homosexual flag, and call it the house of many colors. I point out to people that it makes no difference if your ancestors were Confederates, if your ancestors fought for the Union, or if your ancestors came to the United States long after the Civil War was over. We're all said to benefit from this illegitimate white privilege. We are all guilty. It's as if by breathing the air, we automatically exhale racism and oppression. So this is directed really at all white people and our heritage. It's just the first step of reducing us to a minority and erasing our culture from the collective memory of the United States.
Indeed. Let me go back for a moment again to the conference and everything like that and ask you a little bit about what you're envisioning in the future. Of course, as you say, this is a very successful one. Do you guys want to do more of the same? Do you think, will you be able to expand for next year? More people coming?
It's a real problem. We don't know what to do. We could take a different model and hire something like a government-owned meeting hall and then have people look for accommodation themselves. Traditionally, when we first started holding these conferences, we held them in nice hotels, which could accommodate 1,000 people if we'd been that large. And for many years, this was a successful model. But the left began to put more and more pressure on the hotels to the point where they would actually cancel. It became impossible for us to hold any kind of meetings in privately owned facilities. And that's why we go to Montgomery Bell State Park, because it's owned by the state of Tennessee. I like to have a conference in which everything is under one roof. We have there about 125 sleeping rooms there. We get every last one of them, as well as a number of villas and bungalows that are close to the lodge where the meetings take place. So most people can attend the conference. They can attend the dinners. They can attend the cocktail parties. And they don't have to get in a car and drive home. There's a real kind of sense of being all there in it together. If we were to rent a place, a meeting hall in Washington, D.C. or Charlotte, North Carolina, that's owned by the government, we would have perfect access there, but people would be sort of separated here and there where they were living. We could try to get a block of accommodations in one hotel, but once that were known, then probably there'd be equal kinds of pressure put on the hotel to cancel that. So it's a dilemma. We certainly don't want to be turning people away. And yet, as I say, this model of everything under one roof, which is what we prefer, is something we'd like to stick to. So we're really at the drawing board now in terms of what we're going to do with next year's conference.
Yeah.
But clearly, there is enormous appetite for this kind of opportunity for racially conscious white people to get together. There's just an electric atmosphere. I'll never forget one fellow who was coming back to his second or third conference. He walked in and he walked up to me and said, "It's great to be back among the living again." And that is the sensation you have. You're in a room full of 300 people, all of whom understand, unlike the people that you spend the rest of your life with. So it is absolutely important that these continue to go forward and to grow. We just have to figure out the best way to make that happen.
Yeah, because the facility is very good. As you say, I like that atmosphere, the fact that you have everything close. It's out in nature, which is always nice, actually. You know, if you're tired of the city, and of course, it tends to be more fuzz and protest around that, too, although they do seek themselves out to these remote areas now as well. But yeah, it's a great location, and it's just a question of whether or not you want to grow and do something else where you can actually take in or accommodate more people. And these will be the vintage, old school American Renaissance conferences. Yeah.
Well, one thing that has been proposed to us is that we have several conferences a year and move them around the country. And that way, that wouldn't put so much of a burden on a single facility. Of course, putting on a conference is a very time-consuming and a very burdensome thing for me and for my staff. But that would be an option. Have one in the spring on the West Coast, you know. Have one in the middle of winter, maybe in Colorado or someplace like that. I just don't know. But there is enormous demand for this, and we are going to do our best to meet that demand.
Yeah, it's a great time, and of course, there's a lot of reasons, as you say, for why this is happening. It's not just happening in a vacuum. There's many aspects to this. But Jerry, if we for a moment just talk about kind of the ideas that you and others are communicating when it comes to white identity and why the fact that we are in defense of our heritage and our culture. If we go back and just look at the big picture again, how do you usually introduce this to you speak with media all the time, of course, new people that are unaware of your work and whatever, but how do you try to rein some of these people in and get them, get their awareness opened up in terms of the fact that they are being threatened and that their group existence is actually being attacked by the mainstream?
Well, the work of American Renaissance, I think, falls into two categories. One is race realism, and the other is white advocacy. Race realism is the recognition that race is a biological fact. It's a real natural phenomenon. Unlike this trendy view that somehow it's some sort of sociological optical illusion. As I say to people, the idea that race is somehow only in our minds is so obviously wrong and so obviously stupid that only very, very smart people can persuade themselves that it's true. That races are different, they're not equivalent and not interchangeable, and that it's clear that races build societies of a different kind, of a different texture, of a different tone, wherever you find them. This is a basic important thing that has to be established, that race is a real thing and the races cannot be interchanged. And the other is to point out that whites have legitimate interests just like any other group. And, of course, obviously, ultimately, our main interest is survival as a group. And when you talk to whites, if you explain to them, look, can you name a single majority white, a majority non-white neighborhood that you'd like to live in, or a majority non-white school to which you'd like to send your children? Most whites cannot. In their bones, they know that they are most comfortable in an area that is majority white. And then if you ask them, well, if this is the case, if you cannot name a majority non-white area in the United States you'd like to live in, how can you support immigration policies that are turning more and more parts of the United States into precisely those places where you would not want to live? And I'd like to point out that there's nothing more natural, healthy, nothing more normal than liking to be around people like yourself. When you put it in those simple terms, even liberals often begin to nod their heads and say, well, yes, I see that. And then the other point that I think is vital to explain to whites have to be convinced that what you are asking for is fair, that it is moral. If you were to make a proposal to blacks and say, look, this would be good for black people. You can get wealth from this group, and you will be richer even if they are poorer. I don't think blacks would mind. If you say to whites, this is good for you even if it's not good for others, white people don't like that. They want to think that what they're doing is fair. So you have to point out very clearly that all we are asking for is to be left alone. And what we want for whites is no different from what we are absolutely happy to accord to every other group, that every other group deserves the right to pursue its own destiny, free from the unwanted presence of people unlike themselves. I think if you put things in terms of fairness, in terms of reciprocity, and explain to white people that this is something that all other groups take for granted, only whites are not allowed to express a preference for their heritage, their culture, and their people. It is this kind of double standard that we can use to appeal to whites, and they realize just what kind of crisis they face, as not only in North America, but in Europe, more and more non-whites are coming into their countries, changing their way of life, and threatening to reduce them to minority. I think these are the key points of our movement that, when expressed, I think, in reasonable and reasoned terms, will find a fertile ground. Furthermore, I mean, just looking at the way other people behave, certainly in the United States, Black Lives Matter, for example, they are one of the best advertisements for our point of view that I could possibly think of. It's as if we were paying them. I think Black Lives Matter have driven more whites into some sort of state of racial consciousness than 27 years of American Renaissance activism. So the fact that we have ideas available for people who have been woken up by some event in their lives, I think this combined with the easy access of Red Ice, for example, of American Renaissance, of VDare, of all the other websites, podcasts, broadcasts, clever lyrics to songs that people are writing, meetings, all of this makes it so much easier for white people to see the reality of race in the United States and around the world.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, one of the bigger hurdles that you usually come up against is to try to point out to people that there are differences, right? And that the shape of society and the structure that we as white people are used to in our countries are transforming, in some cases, radically. And I wanted to get your take because obviously you remember Rotherham in England. There's been quite a bit of written about this, obviously, in terms of what happens in some areas where you have these grooming rings that arise. And there is, of course, a racial component to this because all the girls that were exploited was white English girls. And this has, again, now reared its ugly head in Newcastle. This is actually investigations going on from 2010, I believe, up to 2014. There's even some issues where the police themselves actually paid pedophiles to be part of the ring to discover more about it as insiders. This is one of the more controversial issues with it. The story here that I like to focus on when it comes to Newcastle is that the BBC and other media companies, they knew about this. It's actually been going on for years. When it finally broke here, just I think it was yesterday actually, the BBC had already a number of well-produced videos and clips and even documentaries made about this because they were just waiting for the police go-ahead call to focus on the story or to break the story, which shows, of course, that this might be happening in many areas, not only in England, but in other parts in the Western world as well, that we just simply don't know about. You know, these are only a handful that have actually come out. I mean, this is the worst bottom end of the barrel atrocity that can happen, of course, when it comes to, importation of third world populations into our countries, right?
Yes, it's unquestionably the case. When something like this does come to light, in the kind of scale, in the enormity of the things that are discovered that have been concealed, in some cases for many years, then it is inevitable, as you point out, that there be instances of similar kinds of atrocities that do not come to light. You'll remember, of course, New Year's Eve 2 years ago, the attacks in front of the Cologne railroad station where hundreds of young German girls were attacked by this Muslim practice known as Taharush, where they will surround a girl and molest her, this group groping and attempted rape and in some cases actual rape. This had been suppressed by the police, and it was only due to some kind of leak within the police department that this ever became known. And when it became known, it became a scandal, and only because of the scandal was it then revealed that the similar sorts of things had happened in cities all over Germany, all over Europe. There was the same for, I think, there was a Swedish music festival. Every year, it turned out, there had been similar kinds of gropings that the police had never talked about because they don't want to give so-called racists like you and me any kind of ammunition. They want to suppress the truth, and the truth goes against their preconceived views that race doesn't matter and that we're going to all live happily ever after. But no, it's exactly as you point out. We hear about these things that come out years later because they've been deliberately concealed, and we must therefore conclude that there are many, many similarly awful things that never come to light.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, there was protest, of course, in Rotherham specifically when you go back to that case. It was actually quite a large one. A lot of people came out for that. There was a momentum in the town at that time. But still, I'm surprised that there isn't more, frankly, to be honest, more outrage against the authorities after something like this. And it feels to me, anyway, that these kinds of cases they're at the very end of the most extreme example, almost, that you can take of how things completely becomes deconstructed in our societies, right? We are accustomed to, as I say, high trust societies. This is usually what most Western societies are like. And in this case, that has completely fallen apart, and it's a very different culture and customs that comes into the picture. I hear in Afghanistan, for example, they have a huge problem with prostitution of young boys. You know, it's just something which is a seems to be a cultural phenomena which is just so foreign to us, but to them, it's everyday life. So the important thing here, I feel, Jared, is if people are advocating for multiculturalism, things are radically going to change, and those people need to know just what other kinds of values are coming into their society, right? And and that their very children are going to be at risk, you know, from this, right?
To me, frankly, the passivity with which Western societies have accepted this kind of demographic change and the utter passivity with which they see the women of their society taken advantage of. Sweden has now reportedly one of the highest rape rates in the world, certainly in the Western world, because of all of these non-whites who have been pouring into that country. You would think that the nation would rise up in uniform fury and say, no more, ship these people out. And, for example, when we hear about what happened at the Cologne, in front of the Cologne Railroad Station, you wonder, where are German men? What are they doing? Here their women are being surrounded by these Arabs who are molesting them in the worst possible way. Most societies have some sense of solidarity with their own women. When their own women are being molested, raped, in some cases murdered by foreigners, there is a deep, deep protective instinct to put a stop to this. And why this is absent in the West is to me a shocking and intriguing question. In Rotherham, as you pointed out, and other British cities, the police knew what was going on. They turned a blind eye. They turned a blind eye because they didn't want to give the British National Party and these so-called racists any kind of ammunition to advance their arguments. And yet to sacrifice the women of their own tribe, so to speak, on the altar of this kind of political correctness, to me, is something that must be without precedent in the history of the world. This kind of willingness to let innocent young women be exploited by foreigners, because the very idea that we should oppose foreigners at all, this is a kind of insanity that I think the world has never, ever seen before.
Yeah, it's very bizarre, and, you know, frankly, the complacency is a very worrying aspect to this. Obviously, it's changing. It's changing with the information, because we're also working against an establishment that is, you know, denying that these very things have happened. They prepped us for years in terms of the moral question of us not being able to speak up against this, right? So there's a buffer, I guess, rather, of propaganda and information and all of this stuff that we're working up against. But I'm feeling that we're peering through that at this point, and despite the fact that the whole liberal world order is trying to, you know, negate the nationalist parties in Europe, they cannot stop them. They haven't won yet. I mean, the Le Pens and parties in Germany and Sweden, they haven't won yet, but they're getting there. Every year and every election cycle that goes by, more and more people are coming to these parties, so it's heading in the right direction.
Oh, unquestionably. And I think that is that alternative media has been a hugely important aspect of this. There are now so many people who are telling the truth, even just taking cell phone videos and posting them online. It is impossible to ignore this kind of thing. So clearly, the word, the truth, is getting out in a way that was never possible before. As you point out, certainly in Europe, I think I see a lot of grounds for optimism in Europe. Already in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, essentially they have said no immigrants. Or if you've got to take immigrants, they've got to be Europeans. This is a real breakthrough. These are countries in which elected officials are just one step away from saying what you and I say all the time, namely, Europe must remain white. They don't put it quite in those terms. They'll talk about Christian European civilization that must be preserved. It is very encouraging to think that there are governments that are actually operating on this basis. And as you point out, in Western Europe, and we are so far behind in that respect, it's really very sad, but there are the parties in Germany, France. It is true that there have been disappointments. I was very much hoping that, was it Norbert Hofer was his name, was going to be the president of Austria. Well, he won, 46% of the vote. That's a very substantial vote count for an out-and-out nationalist in a tame, emasculated country like Austria. We all hoped that Marine Le Pen would do better in the second round of the elections. 38%, that was a disappointment. But still, that's much better than her father did, 12 years earlier. So this goes to show this is not going to be an overnight success. It's going to be a long, hard struggle. The other side is going to fight desperately, and we must fight even more, in an even more dedicated and systematic and disciplined way if we're going to win. But as I say, for the first time in the 27 years that I've been doing this, I feel genuine optimism that our message is breaking through and that people are acting on it in ways that will ensure a future for us and for our civilization.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, here's a story again out of the UK with the recent Newcastle sex ring being exposed here. Labour, MPs are actually basically using the word to a certain extent that we did years ago, where they talk about how, well, people care more about being called racist or more concerned with that than they actually are about the child abuse itself. It shows, obviously, that people are getting sick and fed up with it. As you say, the rhetoric is changing. People are getting much more bold with the words that they can use to call a spade and actually talk about what this is, which, as you say, that bodes well for us, because it's a return to sanity. It's basically just observing reality as it is, of what it is that's happening in our countries. And finally, at that point, that's when we can actually begin to offer solutions and do something about this. If we don't get to a point where we can address the problems sufficiently, that's never going to happen.
Well, I agree 100%. And I think it is very significant that some labor leaders are coming out and pointing out just how dangerous this kind of self-deception is. I have never considered racial consciousness a right or left phenomenon. Historically, and I think this is a brief period, people who do understand race tend to understand hierarchy, tend to understand distinctions, which are generally more associated with the right than with the left. But in the past, in the United States, for example, in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, you could be an out-and-out leftist in terms of emancipation of women, in terms of the role of government, and still be entirely solid from a racial point of view. And if we are ever going to have areas, ethnostates, or states that are genuinely, self-consciously whites, they're going to have leftist tendencies, rightist tendencies, homosexuals, heterosexuals. There are going to be all kinds of people in them. And I think it's a mistake to associate our ideas with a certain spectrum of politics. We are beyond that. What we wish to do is preserve our race, our people, our tribe, and all of the members of our tribe. And some of them will be right, and some of them will be left. And so it always delights me when people on the left see things in these terms. Pim Fortuyn of the Netherlands, he was an interesting example. He was a fellow who didn't want non-white immigration coming into Holland because he thought that Muslims, Moroccans, Tunisians, all these people coming into Holland would not respect the kind of freewheeling, lefty civilization that he wanted for Holland. Okay, I may have a different view of the destiny of Holland from that of Pim Fortuyn, but we agree that whatever destiny we hope for our countries cannot survive the onslaught of people unlike ourselves. And when leftists begin to realize that, even if it is from a leftist perspective in terms of what they want their countries to be, then we have established a very, very solid basis for acting together to preserve our civilization. And then we can debate about what form that should take. But the basic fundamental issue is to preserve our people and our territories.
Yeah, definitely. I'm surprised that more people, I think Pim Fortuyn, he was homosexual, I believe.
Yes.
And of course, there's many that's come out in the wake of this. Too understandable, but I'm surprised it hasn't been more. I mean, you have in the UK, you have someone like Douglas Murray and even Milo to a certain extent. I don't know if there's any equivalent in the States. There might be, but at least those people who, as you say, I don't care. I don't agree with their lifestyle. I really don't care, as long as they don't push it in my face, if you will. But at least they are intelligent enough to understand that with the importation of Islam into their countries, their lifestyle is going to be challenged, shall we say, where they throw gays off of buildings in these countries that these people come from. So they're intelligent enough to see this, right? But it's surprising that still so few of them have spoken up against it, because it's literally an existential threat to these people.
Yes, yes. It just goes to show you how powerfully this notion of multiracialism has dominated the discourse in the United States and in the Western world. I agree 100% that Pim Fortuyn in Holland, Douglas Murray in England, Milo Yiannopoulos in the United States, all three are homosexuals. I think Murray is not nearly so flamboyant as the other two. But they have the sense enough to realize that, yes, these people want to kill them, for heaven's sake. But for the homosexual movement at large in the United States to have stayed on the sidelines in these debates just goes to show you how intimidated they are by this accusation of racism. Racism is the great sin, and it seems to me that that is really the first one. After that comes homophobia or sexism or xenophobia, whatever these newfangled sins that people have invented for people who have healthy attitudes towards things. Racism is the number one sin. And if we can finally unite with right and left, with all people who share the basic fundamental characteristic of being white, that we must preserve our peoplehood and our genetic substrate, then I think that will be a profoundly important step. When there are people who call themselves leftists, liberals, progressives, who understand that their agenda, what they want for society at large, cannot tolerate a large influx of non-whites. And I think bit by bit, more and more of them are beginning to realize that. Here in the United States, we have supporters of Bernie Sanders, the Bernie Bros, as they're called. More and more of them have begun to take on kind of an anti-white stance. I wouldn't call them pro-white, but they are very much upset at this notion that white people are the problem, that Hillary Clinton was constantly running down white people. No, they say, look, white people are oppressed by the system just like everybody else. And they are beginning to realize that turning everything into an anti-white issue is a non-starter. I think some of those people could come our way in terms of their understanding of race without abandoning their leftist principles. And I say, come one, come all. I don't necessarily agree with some of those leftist principles, but we have a fundamental commonality, and that is our race, and that is our European heritage.
The conservatives are more difficult to work with than some lefties in some regards, because at least the lefties actually have an understanding comprehension of identity politics, right? So that they understand that, you know, there are different groups, they have their, you know, exclusive, you know, maybe cultural nuances at least. They might not believe that race is a important enough issue, but at least they're close enough, which almost make the conservatives the more difficult party to work with here to a certain extent. You'd think that they'd be more on the right, they would be more, but no, they just don't see race, they don't want you to talk about it, and I think that they have some kind of inherent belief too that if the left just stopped talking about race, all of the issues would disappear, right? They think that it's not. They almost believe that it is something which is a social construct. And, of course, what people like yourself are talking about is, no, it's actually biological. Sure, there are cultural aspects to it as well, the culture you grew up in, etc. But it's a genetic issue to a very large degree. And that is something that's important. That's why we come back to the science again, right? That this has to be, it has been proven, but it has to be reproven to many of these people so they understand, right?
Yes, yes, unquestionably. Everything, I agree 100%. Oddly, conservative whites, and there's only one kind of conservative largely in the United States. A black conservative is such a rarity. You know what they call a black person who attends a conservative convention? You call such a person the keynote speaker.
Yeah, exactly. Always.
Yes, yes. But no, these white people who think, certainly in the United States, that they are working to preserve small government. They love the Constitution. They love all of our rights to bear arms, et cetera, et cetera. These people have no idea that what they are fighting for requires white people. They have this notion that so long as we maintain a certain form of government, so long as we maintain the flag, then it doesn't make any difference who you bring to the United States, so long as they're properly told what to do, et cetera, et cetera. This is just such incomprehensible folly, But you will find that it is conservatives who more frequently quote Martin Luther King on this crazy line about how we have to be judged on the content of our character rather than the color of our skin. Conservatives love to quote Martin Luther King because they think it inoculates them against any accusation of racism. Of course, what they don't realize is that Martin Luther King, certainly by the end of his life, believed in quotas. He believed in racial preferences for blacks. This stuff about on the content of your character, that was just public consumption in these big rallies. No, no, no. He would have moved right along with this notion that no, for equal opportunity is not enough. Equal outcome is absolutely essential. But yes, conservatives are a peculiar and hard case.
Yeah, they certainly are. So actually, as we carry on in the next segment, I want to ask you a little bit more about James Damore, actually. The issue, it's not related to race, but it's actually another component to the issue of biological differences when it comes to the sexes, actually, the genders. This is an interesting case. So let's go into that more in a second. But take a moment here to tell us more about the website. Tell us about how people can support the work that you do. Obviously, the conference is just over, but is there anything upcoming, I guess, people should look out for on the site or so forth?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. Our website is Amren, AMREN.com. And we certainly can't compete with the quality of your productions, but we make videos from time to time. We hold conferences, we publish monographs, and we'll be coming out with a book very soon, which is a collection of what I think is my best writing over the last 25 years as being an activist. It's called If We Do Nothing. And I hope that some of your viewers and listeners will consider buying and reading that book. It's interesting to me that these days, when people call up the office and want to know more about American Renaissance, they never say, I read this great article, or I read this insightful book. They say, I saw this great video. I'm still old-fashioned enough to like to read things, but these days people seem to be more persuaded by things that are images or podcasts rather than reading. And so we're trying to move as much as possible into that direction. But perhaps as a last gasp, we have come out with a collection of what I think is my best short stuff. And I think readers will find it accessible, and I hope they'll find it illuminating.
Great. When was the publishing date on that again, you said?
Well, at the conference, we had a few pre-release copies of it available, sold them out, and very soon it should be available on the Internet, I would say in about a week or two at the most, both in print and electronic form. It'll be called If We Do Nothing.
Great. So definitely look out for that. And folks, of course, if you're unfamiliar with it, check out the other books Jared has authored, like White Identity, Racial Consciousness in the 21st Century. You have Paid with Good Intentions and Face to Face with Race. And also, of course, Amren, through the New Century Foundation, is releasing The Color of Crime. I think that's an updated version, 2016, there as well.
Yes, that's right. That's always one of our most popular monographs. People are fascinated by the irrefutable facts about race and crime. When I used to do a lot of radio, that was the only subject on which I would be invited by a radio station to talk about. This would be the different crime rates by race. I would be on one station, and then people in the competing talk station at the same city would call me up and say, "Hey, we have to have you on to talk about this." It was fascinating to me because if you talk about FBI supplied crime statistics, this seems to be one of the genuinely acceptable ways for white people to talk about race. And if you really couch it in terms of numbers that no one can reasonably disagree with, this seems to be a kind of a emotional or psychological outlet for people who otherwise would be too terrified to talk about crime, to talk about race. They can talk about crime, but they won't talk about, say, race and IQ or something like that, or right. The interests of whites as a group.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of information there to dig into. And, of course, the videos as well from the Amren conference has been released on Amren.com as well. So definitely check that out. Do you guys have DVDs of that available, or it goes up on your YouTube these days, maybe?
It just goes up on the YouTube.
Yeah.
It used to be that we would release DVDs and sell them at a nominal cost, but now people can just watch them for free on our YouTube channel, and that's we're happy to make them available for free.
Excellent. Yeah, stay with us, everyone. We're just going to take a short break. We'll be back with Jared Taylor in the second segment. We'll see you on the other side. Stay tuned.